Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to the Roots of Energy Efficiency. This is the third in a series of events on the history and future of energy efficiency in California. I'm Andrew Hargadon with the UC Davis Energy Efficiency Center, and I'll be moderating this panel discussion on affecting end user behavior in achieving energy efficiency. It's a wonderful opportunity, in fact, to come third, despite the cost of following in Martin's footsteps. We have the opportunity to now build on the discussions of the previous panels, which I think have set us up very well. It's an opportunity now to talk about the role that energy sort of end-user behavior has and can play on achieving energy efficiency goals. I think the challenge that the previous panels have set for us is that balance between control of end-user behavior and empowerment of end-users and what they're able to do. It's a control that's very nice. I think, you know, we have on the one hand, Mike Peavy's rational man, and the ability of people to respond to price signals. I think, you know, from all we know, people do respond to price signals. They hear them. They just don't hear them very well. So you have to speak very clearly. A couple of examples of that. We know that, you know, Juneau, Alaska was able to reduce its energy efficiency, or its energy intensity, its energy consumption by 30% practically overnight based on some very, very strong price signals in the early 2000s. And Brazil was also able to reduce its energy consumption as a nation by about 20%, again with strong price signals in 2002. These were the threats of, I think, doubling or tripling of their energy bills, or in the case of Brazil, actually simply disconnecting anybody who used, who didn't reduce their consumption by 20%. So those are nice price signals, and if you can pull them off, if you can speak that clearly, people's behavior does become rational. But on the other side, we have the question of what can people do and what will people do if they're empowered, if the information is set free. And I think this is going to be a lively discussion we have about that, because we have some wonderful people to talk about it. So with that, I will now introduce, in fact, our panel very briefly. Nicole Biggert, on your left, is the director of the UC Davis Energy Efficiency Center. Then we have Alex Alasky from OPower, Gene Rodriguez from the Southern California Edison, and then Carrie Armel from Stanford's Precor Center for Energy Efficiency. And with that, I'll let the panelists give us a brief, their brief thoughts first, and then we'll go to questions.
Okay, great. I've recently been thinking about the first job I had out when I finished my undergraduate degree, before I went to graduate school. I worked in Washington, D.C. for the Postmaster General. This was in the 1970s. And what the reason I've been recently thinking about it, because I think there are some parallels. This was a time when the post office was trying to take what was a public utility and move it more toward a more sensitivity to the market. You know, you paid for your postage stamp and you expected your mail. And you know, one of the post offices in New York, the saying, neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night will stay these couriers from their appointed rounds, which is from Herodotus. And I don't, you know, but this was the Persian mail service. I'm not sure why it made it to the New York City post office, but there it is, something from Iran. It was so emblematic of the really deeply felt sense within the Postal Service, and you might laugh at this, but sense that we've got to go through the snow, we've got to deliver the mail, we just have to do it, and people really felt that very strongly. Now, whether people cared about getting their mail during a blizzard, well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Maybe if you gave them a reduced cost for mail, they would prefer that. Nobody actually knew, but the point was there was a service ethic for this huge organization, the largest non-military organization in the world. It was huge. There were like 700,000 employees in every single place in the in every neighborhood in our country. But nobody had bothered to ask the customers what they wanted, and it was a real aha moment when I joined the organization as part of this little team of people to start thinking about what would we do with 28,000 retail outlets if we treated them as retail outlets and not just places where people picked up their mail or bought their stamps. And so it was a really interesting time, and I am getting the sense that we are in an interesting time of that magnitude here. We need to start thinking about, and I don't want to say that utilities don't think about me. I'm a PG&E customer. Treat me as a customer, but I think it's different when you have something like a smart meter that really can put you in partnership with your customer, where the customer can send you information and you can send the customer information. Everything changes. Absolutely everything changes. And I think it's going to be, I honestly think it's going to, after the really difficult first moments of working with things like smart meters and consumer-based products, that there's going to be great learning and the potential for a much stronger relationship between the customer and the energy producers. A tremendous, with a lot of third parties involved in between, I think there's going to be a great deal more possible if we get it right. And we'll have a lot more to say, but one of the things that I want to suggest about getting it right is that we don't treat the customer as an individual only. Sometimes it's an individual who makes the choice. When you're talking about customers who live in households, who live in contexts, you really have got to start getting inside the context. When Procter & Gamble is researching a new product, they use anthropologists. They see how those products are used inside a household. Who makes the decision? Do they add embellishments to it? Do they customize it? How smart meters are used, how energy is thought about and used in the household, it's going to be something we need to investigate in a way that we simply haven't before. And it's going to be it's going to take some new skills that I think this industry has not been used to having to use. So that's my opening thought.
Just to get my history correct.
Yeah.
Was that about the time that FedEx and UPS began eating the post office's lunch?
That's a good point.
I want to move to Alex.
The first
this is going to be a tough one, I can tell.
In the 1970s, the first new product that the Postal Service had. The previous new product, Express Mail was the first one since Airmail in 1917. So they were not thinking about the customer.
Good. So we stand on the cusp.
Thank you. My name is Alex Lasky. Thanks for having me. I've been thinking a lot about, and today is being at an event that's sponsored by a university, I'm thinking about it. Particularly, I'm thinking about my mother, who next Thursday, and I'm thinking about her and smiling, which is not, anyway. Next Thursday, I'm going to my mother's retirement party. She's been a middle school teacher teaching English for 39 years. And so I've been thinking about her a bunch, and being up in front of an audience of people makes me think more about her. And I had a question for the audience, which is, raise your hand if you love your mother. Not my mom, your own mom. a lot of hands up. Shifting gears slightly, raise your hand if you checked your email today. How about stock portfolio or your 401k? This week, anybody check that? Decent number of hands. How many people today have checked their home energy usage? How about in the last week? How about in the last month? So herein lies the problem. We've been talking all day about the implementation of new technologies that will help engage customers. And yet, even in this room, among this self-selecting audience, next to none of you have any clue as to how your house is using energy. And I'm in your camp, incidentally. This is not... And so the question is, the challenge is, and it's a challenge for the people in this room, it's a challenge, fortunately, also for the people beyond this room, is how do we change customer behavior when there's limited customer initiative? And it's not, to sort of tie a bow around this, it's not because customers are uninterested. 90% of people, when surveyed, say that saving energy is important to them and something they think is a good idea, and that wasting energy is a bad idea. 9 in 10. 78% of people say that they love their mother. So I think the numbers were higher in this room. Probably in both regards. But it's not that people aren't motivated to save. Most people would like to save energy and use it more wisely. It's that they have awfully busy lives. They're checking their email, they're checking their stock portfolio, they're checking on their children.
Who don't love them, by the way.
Yeah, well, only 22% of them don't love them. Here's the opportunity, right? You have a situation in which people are motivated, but they have a lot of other things in their lives. And energy information was hit upon earlier. There's two problems with it, and they're not going to be changed, incidentally, by going to smart meters. One is it's boring as sin. Data alone, energy data coming off meters, whether it's read once a month or once an hour, is boring. And this was talked about quite a bit, the financial mechanisms, unless you triple the price, are not significant. The idea of spending a lot of your time in order to save 5% off a $100 bill that's not a good economic trade-off. And so the opportunity has to be, how do we take this information, this data coming off these meters, transform it into information that is engaging for customers, that proactively is delivered to customers? We can't wait for customer initiative because it doesn't exist. And so I think the good news is that there's an answer. That the application of behavioral science, the application of marketing and data-driven marketing and the opportunity to provide individualized information, I think several people have talked about it today, individual information to customers that is simple, that doesn't take a lot of people's time, doesn't require them to seek it out, that's relevant for them, that is to say that we deliver a certain piece of information to one customer and a different piece of information to another, and that's actionable and motivating, that's key to driving changes in customer behavior. We're a software company. We're going to hit the 100-person mark this month. We work with 35 utilities across the U.S. It's exciting for us. We're driving 2.5% reductions in consumption now across nearly 2 million homes. 2.5% is insignificant. It's not enough to get somebody to do very much in their own house. But, of course, 2.5% across the country, across utility territories, is substantial. I'm very optimistic at our ability, and it won't just be us, but our ability to derive additional insights and to provide additional communications channels that are specifically smart grid enabled. And I'll maybe later in the conversation be able to talk to some of that.
Good.
Thanks. You missed out on one of the advantages of being on the last panel, is that you get to opine on what everyone else said, so I'm going to do that. This has been a pretty good conference so far, wouldn't you agree? A lot of very, very important information about technology and about policy. Unfortunately, there was one outrageous lie that was told earlier today, and I'm going to reveal it to you. Martin Giles sat at this table, and the learned reporter from The Economist said, "Knowledge is power." Nonsense. Knowledge, when followed by virtuous, intelligent action, is power plants. And that's the opportunity that behavior brings for us, but it's also, as Nicole and Alex have pointed out, the challenge before us. Because unlike your Econ 101 class, you cannot look outside these windows and outside these doors and see a world populated by rational economic actors who, with the right price signals and with the right sets of incentives and the right sets of knowledge, are going to go out and do all the energy efficiency they should do. Because if I ask you, if every one of you in your own home or business has done all the energy efficiency that is cost effective, that means it will pay back in a reasonable period of time. No one who is telling the truth can raise our hand in this room. Not even me. Not even my mom, who's more virtuous than Alex's mom.
My mom's tougher than your mom.
I'll give you that.
And she's tougher than you, too.
I will grant you that as well.
And she's going to have a lot of free time on her hands after the rest of the day.
I will also tell you that no matter how much we in this room, the virtuous few, the enlightened ones, think that we see the path that's out there, it is not a world that we can say that we live in where we are really the majority that is making a tremendous difference that will change the course of climate change on this planet. So the challenge and the promise of behavior is that if somehow, I don't know if it's through education or some other sort of engagement, but somehow if we can get the virtuous few in this room to be just part of the great unwashed, so that every single person outside of this room is doing their share, that is the promise of behavior. Now the challenge is, as I said before, look around this room. A lot of really good looking people, that's the only thing we have in common. We are all different, we all respond to different triggers, etc. You see the same thing outside of that room. So anybody who comes in and tells you, we need only send price signals, we need only educate about the importance of climate change and our action in it, we need only to put a little display on our refrigerator so we can, like a Prius, we can see what's going on, that is an extremely naive and, quite frankly, counterproductive view of the world. What we need to figure out is what are the right sets of technologies that enable us to mine the right amount of efficiency and conservation from every single person out there. Some of that can be done through regulation. We can take away some bad choices out of the market, but the rest of it, the majority of it, and I would say even in the great state of California, where we consider ourselves to be a little more progressive than many of the other states around the country, most of it will have to come from getting people to behave virtuously, even if they don't want to. Even if they don't want to sit around doing a calculation every day or thinking about a dial every day or making 1,000 choices. We need to find a way to herd the great sheep in the right direction so that we mine enough efficiency to make a difference.
Good. Carrie.
So I thought I'd start a discussion of behavior by listing types of behaviors, because oftentimes when I talk to people, they think that behavior refers to turning on, you know, turning off lights, et cetera. So behavior changes that we might want to facilitate to reduce energy use might be reducing waste, getting rid of the fridge in the garage, helping people set controls and timers and settings, maintenance behaviors, the purchase and installation and proper use of energy efficient technologies, as well as the habits such as shutting off lights, et cetera. I also wanted to comment just briefly on the interplay between policy and behaviors, because sometimes people talk about policy as though they're gonna, it may solve everything, but I think there's a strong interplay between policy and behavior. So we may have policies that facilitate programmable thermostats, for example, but if people aren't setting them properly or uptaking them at a steady rate of diffusion, then we might not get the benefits. Incentives may help people act, but people have to have the right actions to take. So that's a couple of comments. We've been talking so far about behaviors that could be facilitated from the smart grid and that we can get energy reductions. And there's a couple of articles that have come out in the past year or two saying that, and also as alluded to earlier, that probably we could get around 20 to 30% energy reductions in the residential sector without a lot of sacrifice. And so that's great. But there's the $20 on the sidewalk problem, and how do we actually get that? So, and I think that is likely to be pretty hard, like Jean was saying. But I also wanted to highlight a bunch of additional benefits that I think the smart grid can enable, because I think there's a lot more out there. So if we think about it, we have an enormous opportunity on our hands right now. We have pervasive web-enabled computers and mobile devices that we can provide programs and interventions to people if they're interested in looking at it, which is a problem that Alex alluded to. Plus, we now are going to have pervasive sensors. And this is in the form of smart meters, also home area networks, but there's transportation sensors that are coming out. There's health sensors. Nike and Apple had some sensors to record footsteps. The cost of wireless sensors have come down tremendously, and they're likely to become pervasive and already are. So there's the combination of these two, I think, offer a device and behavior change system, as well as a tremendous amount of data of programs that can be adjusted and objective measures of energy use or behavior change that can be recorded. And those two together are very powerful in enabling a lot of things. One of these things is facilitating behavior change. Another is helping utilities, Google, researchers, et cetera, develop programs and policies. So we can look at this information at a scale never before studied to develop best practices with unprecedented speed, ease, cost, and scale. That's a really interesting opportunity. I think it was mentioned in the previous panel that the coupling of the programs with objective measures of energy use could transform evaluation. So right now, the utilities have a strong burden of proof to demonstrate that coupons and rebates or other programs change behavior. They tend to use coupons and rebates because there is this strong link. But if we can objectively measure energy use through smart meters or other energy sensors, that allows us to record those savings and also to diversify behavioral programs that haven't been diversified before. Another advantage is that economic models before have not been able to incorporate behavior as well because it's been difficult to quantify behavior. So it allows that to be incorporated, and these economic models with behavior coupled on can now inform policy. Engineering models. Typically, there's a discrepancy between modeled building energy use and actual building energy use. And part of that discrepancy is because we don't really understand how people are using the energy in the buildings. And so, again, this data can help provide insights into that. If we can get down to the appliance level, there's opportunities for doing appliance research and innovations. We can say, where is the energy being wasted and how can we innovate? So it allows us to target there. Utilities to do load research and forecasting. And a lot of these benefits will help improve the economy by providing new opportunities for products and innovations, as well as improve energy security. So I think there's a huge opportunity for benefits here. There seems to be a large, the smart grid is being rolled out very quickly, and there's not a lot of research being done on how we can realize all of these benefits from the smart grid. So I think that that's a really important area for future directions. Just one last point. Our group at Stanford recently received an Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy Award. This is an ARPA-E. It's a new agency modeled off of DARPA to do high-risk, high-return research. And our award was the only award that was behaviorally related. And the specific goal of the award was to leverage wireless energy sensors with behavioral techniques to maximize energy savings. It's a very interdisciplinary group. We have about 15 faculty across 10 departments, including computer science and management sciences and engineering, to psychology, education, and public health. So I think that our effort will be one effort to address some of these benefits and see how we can realize those benefits, but I hope that there's a lot more effort in that direction.
Good, thanks. So I have a question for the group now. We heard a lot today, from others about what could be happening. I think in other places it might even be called sort of techno-porn. The notion of all of the things that are going to be possible. This is the meal and the pill of energy efficiency, the flying car and all those other things, the moving sidewalks. I would like to know, and particularly from Alex and Jean, who are living in this world, What are we doing now? What currently has come onto the market that is focused on affecting user behavior? These are early days, and I want to know what we've learned so far from the products we've put out that actually directly affect user behavior, to separate that from all of the things we've talked about that could happen.
Go ahead. Okay. I'll start off and then trade it on over. Well, there's two things that are abundantly clear from what we know so far. Number one, we don't need to wait for technology to come in and rescue us from ourselves. For goodness sake, we've got all the technology we need available to us today to make the California, strike that, the United States energy-consuming infrastructure infinitely more energy efficient than it is today. And then when you couple that with the behaviors that, again, this room full of the virtuous few, if you look at how much more we could do, and then how much more we could do if we had a little better technology basis to allow us to do that, think of that across every home, every street, every city, etc. So what we know so far is we don't need to await technology to rescue us. What we need in this country, what we need in California, is more systematic efforts to grow, mine, harvest, whatever analogy you want to use, conservation benefits or behavioral benefits, and do so in systematic ways that aren't held hostage to the fact that behavior isn't technology. What makes technology something that we can invest in is that it's easy to measure.
Yeah, I'm going to push you back there, Gene.
Please.
You tell me, what have we done that has shaped it?
So I think there's two kinds of things that are tremendously important. I'll use just Southern California Edison as an example. So within the behavior model right now, we have a couple of things. Number one, we use a couple of pilots, Alex's company being one of them, but a couple of pilots that look at proving to regulatory certainty what we already know, which is that if you give people information, if you give people incentives and signals, that we can allow them to behave a little better, and then we try to bring engineering in the background or estimation principles in the background to prove with some regulatory certainty that what we already know will happen happens and is some way quantifiable. The second thing that I think is tremendously important is it goes to something that actually Mike Peavy, who's still in the back of the room, said earlier. A big change in the way California looks at what smart meters, smart grids enable is that in the old days, it was all about the economics of doing advanced metering, which was just basically getting remote reads and getting fewer people on the streets, et cetera. What the vision of smart metering is that built into every business case is a conservation benefit, et cetera. What we know is that where you put that meters in place right now, we don't yet have measured data that tells us that people can serve, but we know for a fact that that's going to happen. We know for a fact that behavior is something that results from giving the right information, the right signals. Okay. We know for a fact that pricing can make a difference. All of these things are knowable and known in California. All we haven't done in California is take that and put it into a large, systematic effort to mine it.
Okay.
Just two things. I want to talk about what we've seen doesn't work, and I think what we have seen has worked. So it's tempting in the Computer History Museum, and I think it's tempting among the engineers who very appropriately run utility companies to think that hardware and technology are what's going to solve these problems. And we, Dan Riker talked earlier today about using CT clips to attach a meter to his electric panel in his house. There are relatively few Dan Rikers, unfortunately, and any solution that's dependent on new hardware into the home is one that has been, I think, pretty clearly demonstrated. If you look at the adoption curve and the adoption rates of these new displays and devices, it's pitifully small. Very few people, consumers are not flocking to take advantage of them. And if you look even at Gene, at SEE's smart grid filing, which was approved by the commission in 2009, you look at their predicted adoption rate for not only new hardware, so in-home displays, which people have been talking about earlier, and displays on appliances and so on, but also even for web presentment, essentially people going online to seek out this information. It's right now at around 10%, which I think is perhaps a little aggressive, but the anticipation is that by 2020 it's going to be 36%. Of course, what that leaves out is that in 2020, which is 10 years from now, if we're dependent on in-home displays or online presentation of information, 64% of Californians are not going to be engaged. We cannot afford to wait to engage those customers. We can't, if we're only communicating through these displays and through the computer, we're going to be failing. And so what's the answer? The answer is essentially being channel agnostic, saying let's not meet customers where we wish they were, which is to say let's not hold out hope that everybody's going to become Dan Riker overnight, but instead let's deliver information to all customers where they'd like to receive it. And as anachronistic as it seems, and it goes back to what Nicole led with in your first job, the U.S. Postal Service, rain, shine, snow, et cetera, still delivers information to people. And it is the way the overwhelming majority of customers interact with their utility presently, and the implementation of smart meters is not going to change that. There's an opportunity. We're one company that's demonstrated it, but whether it's through the mail, through email, through text messages, outbound phone calls, and we're doing all of those things, that providing people with basic information, some context to understand their consumption, and then very targeted, we have a team of people from Capital One and Amazon.com to make sure that we send the right message to the right customer at the right time, that even without price signals, and I agree with Gene, the price signals will become incremental, but even without price signals, there's the opportunity to move not just the Dan Rikers of the world, but not just the rest of us energy dorks in this room. I say that with love. But the overwhelming majority of customers. And the numbers are staggering. We're going to save this year, in partnership with utilities like SMUD, in partnership with utilities like SoCal Edison, we're going to save customers 350 gigawatt hours of energy. Put that in context, the entire solar industry in this country is going to produce 900 gigawatt hours. We're a small company, 100 people, 350 gigawatt hours, one-third the size of the solar industry. I hope they grow. We're going to grow, too.
Good. So, and that's, if I understand correctly, that's the 2.5% of that you...
That's right. And I think what's important about it is it's you can deploy it without waiting for the technology.
Sure.
You can do it with old-fashioned meters. There are incremental benefits that we're already measuring from the opportunities with new meters, but... it's incumbent upon the utilities to act now, and it's incumbent upon their regulators to create an environment in which they're incented to act now. We can't afford to wait for these to be all the meters to be deployed and working, and we can't afford to wait both because our environment depends on it, but we can't afford to wait because of what we're seeing happening in places like Bakersfield and in Texas, whereas there's too much expectation and hype about the smart grid. You can't. It has to happen in parallel. You have to engage your customers right away.
So the next question is one of understanding the actual market and the entire marketplace, because again, we're talking about the end user, but I have two questions and I want to address them to Carrie and Nicole as well, which is who's the consumer who's driving the market structure? What we haven't really talked about directly, although in many cases touched on it obliquely, is that the customer is in many ways the utility. And the utility's effort to respond to the utility commission in terms of measurement verification, in terms of buying your services.
Sure.
And the extent to which that is driving the ultimate products in the market and the ultimate value that comes from it, rather than so we can talk about giving the end user healthcare, but if it's the insurance companies that are driving the process, are we really, what are we really maximizing on? So I want to ask you that about the
industry. Sure. I actually had the aha moment when I got my PG&E brochure that said, oh, you have a new smart meter. And that was exciting, all the things it was going to do for me. And I said, I got to go find it. And I had to, you know, put on my raincoat, go out, push the shrubs away, and with my, it was clear I was not the consumer, certainly not for that device. It was not designed for my ease of use. I was happy today to hear that it's going to enable things that potentially will. But right now, I'm not the consumer, and even if I were the consumer, there are many other consumers who are quite different from me. And I think, you know, we think about users in the market as somehow unsegmented when we've been talking about energy users, and which is the way, frankly, economics thinks about, you know, rational actors, and we're all the same. But clearly, we've just learned that your mother is different from Jean's mother, and they probably use their energy differently. We learned earlier today that the people in Sebastopol are very different from the people in San Diego. And so Sebastopol, and I have a theory about it, why that's the case. You know, it's a social network theory. I suspect that the people in Sebastopol, a few people are tightly linked there and spread the word about the bad things that will happen to you, whereas it's a far more dispersed network in San Diego. Sociologists can come up with all kinds of hypotheses. But we're not all the same. We're not linked to each other the same. And that can be a very good thing, too, because it means there are many different ways to get at the market for energy. Some of them are the ultimate consumer like me. Some it's the utility. Some it may be the businesses that supply it. They're all different market points that have to be brought along. So I've got lots of hypotheses.
Perry, who's driving the shape of the industry? Which consumer?
Let's see. Currently, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot out there for consumers. There's smart meters, and you might be able to access a web page with a graph of your hourly energy use. The data isn't formulated in, I'd say, sexy ways to really engage people. Home area networks really haven't hit the market yet. Pilot tests are just starting to be done. So I'm not sure. I mean, in a way, it's a difficult question to answer because it's not out there for the consumer to receive yet. In places like Europe, where their home area networks have been on the market a little bit, it looks like, and this is just anecdotal from talking to a company over there, it looks like more high-tech, greeny-type people are the ones purchasing home area network equipment. There's high cost if you want to set up a home area network, and there's effort involved in plugging in all of your appliances if you want plug load monitors, and if you want to unplug things, you need to change the identifiers associated, you need to put in the labels. So I think in a way, Apple's approach to envisioning what benefit there could be for consumers and creating a product that offers those benefits is a task that we need to do to increase the uptake and diffusion once these products are on the market. I think there's a lot that could be done to do that, but I think that it's going to require a lot of work.
Can I offer one slightly contentious counterpoint to the way you framed your question? I would say this. If there's anything that can be learned about where this country is today, it's that the fact that we look to the consuming public to drive the market is absolutely stupid. Because if you think about it, right now, in every state of the United States, there are people in white, permanent press, short-sleeved dress shirts with clip-on ties who are doing long-term resource planning for that utility. What does that mean? They're thinking about spending billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars building the next generation of power plants to serve the needs, the energy-consuming needs of this country over the next 20 years. What California does right is it says, look, we don't believe that the market has truly expressed an intelligent preference for the amount of efficiency that's being done. And so we're willing to invest in energy efficiency as a resource. And I would say there's not a single person in this room who would agree that the market has expressed an intelligent preference for how much efficiency needs to be done to address global warming. So if that is the case, the consumer, as the utilities and the utilities across the United States, that makes sense to me, because there's a tremendous checkbook about out there of money that's going to otherwise be invested in supply side resources that ought to be diverted in significant ways to making consumers smarter about how they consume energy and providing them with the resources to save energy.
I hate to say this, but I agree with Gene. If we wait for consumers to change the market will never change. And the reason is that the status quo is awfully good. Yeah. In most places in this country, power is cheap, it's reliable, and you don't have to think about it. Why would you want to change that? So if we're going to change the market, and we have to change the market, it's going to be regulation and policy. Gene's a good guy. There are lots of good people at utilities, but they're not going to go out of their way to reduce revenue unless they're compensated. And they exist in synthetic markets that are shaped by regulation. California's done a phenomenal job at crafting that regulation. There's still more to be done. There's still more to be done elsewhere in the country. But the utilities, the bar should be raised. Utilities should be pushed hard to go after big savings and big numbers, and when they hit those numbers, and they can, they need to be rewarded.
I think we need to think of this not just as a short-term problem, but a really longer-term set of issues, and look at education. Davis has roots in agriculture. We've always supported the 4-H, and the 4-H was really an insidious organization. It was a stealth organization. You'd teach the kids the latest farming methods, and they would go home and tell their farm parents the right way to do things. You could never tell the parents, but the kids could start doing it. We can do this. With the next generation, we can send home the little kilowatt devices. We can teach them about it, and they will, just like they got their parents off of cigarettes, they can be much more energy aware. So it's already changed. You look at any of our universities today, our students now are very, very energy aware. They're very green. They're all recycle. We can do a short-term policy thing. We can do longer-term intergenerational education. We have so many things we can do that are not economically directed. People don't litter anymore. You wouldn't dare think about leaving your hose running when you're washing your car and just letting it go into the street. People don't do that. There are many, many ways that we can do non-economic. We need our policies. We need economic incentives. But we have a whole lot of other things that are not technology related that can, over time, be extremely effective.
So yeah, let me build on that question. I think part of my earlier question was. How Michael Pollan sort of shined a light on the food industry. And the reason we have 7 brands of Apple now when there were 1,000 and something 100 years ago was not because the consumer wanted less choice in the number of apples, despite the fact that there are any number of consumers who each have their own preference. It was because the retailers, the grocery stores, wanted less, they wanted more volume with less accounting hassle of having to order from 1,000 different vendors. So, so a lot of those people inside the supply chain, particularly the utilities, will be making their own preference choices about who they buy from, who they partner with, who they provide access to their customers. And so in many ways, the technology that is offered to the consumer is going to be shaped by all of these other players. So, Nicole, when you bring up the other side, the education and the demand side shifts that have nothing to do with technology, we start to get into what may be the one thing that we can control that isn't sort of embedded in the economic structure of the market. So now coming back to Alex, what do we face in this world? If we start to think about the different qualitative values of energy efficiency, in the way you'd think of the different qualitative values of the apples, Are we going to be posting our daily utility rates or on Facebook? Are we going to be shaming our neighbors, poking them with how low we are compared to them? What are the human emotional levers that you guys are going to pioneer?
Sure.
And psych ops to control this?
Well, I think. I don't know is the answer to there are a lot of different things that we're trying right now, and some of them are working quite well. I think, though, one of the things you were alluding to, I believe, was, and there was a bunch of conversation earlier, are the utilities really the right people to do this? Or should this be, should we liberate the data to people like Google and Microsoft? And I alluded to policy being important. I don't think, I have no particular opinion about whether data should be liberated or not, but I do think that if we're dependent on outside forces, Facebook, Google, we're not going to get the job done. Again, the business interests of Google and Facebook are orthogonal to efficiency, and the utility's business interests can be directly tied to the achievement of efficiency. And the sad reality is that an apple tastes a lot better than energy efficiency, and so customers are more engaged in choice about apples. I think there's the reality is the. And there's a battle that's looming between utilities and third parties. And I think it's the utilities' battle to lose not because they're better at software than Google is, but because they have two distinct advantages. One is they have the opportunity to run opt-out programs rather than opt-in programs. Google needs customers' permission to do something. We're going to wait for customer permission. We're going to end up in a situation with relatively few people signing up. Because again, it's neither sexy nor financially interesting, so why bother? And two, the utility has not only the opportunity but the obligation to serve all of its customers. So if directed by regulation in the right direction, the utility can communicate to all of its customers. Two, the other reason the utility is going to win if it does things right is that nobody has built a business successfully yet on the purchase of efficient products. Whirlpool has a successful business, but it's not because it is because getting people to buy more efficient things. It's an incremental piece. However, there are businesses being demonstrated that are proven to get customers to make efficient choices about behavior to the point Carrie made. And why that advantages the utility is that the utility is the only one with the access to funding, in the case of public purpose funds, to fund that kind of business. That is to say, the utility has access to those funds to drive efficient behavior among its customers. So it's for those two reasons, I think, that the utility, if it acts intelligently, which it doesn't always do, has the opportunity to really win this and to deliver real value to its customers and at the same time value to its shareholders.
Gary, can you tell me a little bit about the user behavior levers that we can use?
Okay, so public health has been studying this for decades now. For our program, we've adopted a model from public health that says that multiple types of programs or interventions are more effective than just one. So, for example, if you build walking paths in a city and you don't have a marketing plan, a marketing program, as well as walking clubs, then you're not going to get as many people walking as if you have them together. So I think for energy efficiency and taking advantage of the data that's available for the smart grid, we're going to need a combination of these different techniques. So to illustrate, I think we'll need innovative media strategies. So, just as an example, Farmville is a recent social online game in which 90 million people are currently playing, which is pretty shocking. There's a professor on our team who studies games, and he studies the application of games for serious contexts. And behavior change, these games are used in companies like IBM, et cetera, as well as in the public. So there's some interesting opportunities there. Policy changes in the form of incentives or the application of behavioral economic principles to the consumer. So we have one person on our team who has, for the amount of money that an individual would save for making one behavior change, the amount of savings is very small. But if you could pool that money together, it becomes much more motivating. And so he did essentially a lottery in India that's now being adopted across the country, where riders got tickets into a lottery if they shifted their time of transportation, and then every few weeks somebody would win from the lottery, and they'd get the pool of savings that were created from the shift in time. So we're actually trying to apply this model to electricity use. I mean, you can think about it in shifting demand or in reducing energy use. Basically, you get a pool of money, and it could go to the community or the individual. Community-based programs to reinforce and create action on the ground. So a lot of these energy efficiency changes in homes happen physically rather than through online media. And we know that people informing their neighbors and conversations that way have a very strong influence on behavior. So we actually have a program that we're beginning to develop with the Girl Scouts to leverage the online media and create community action through these diffusion channels. We have media is one type of program or intervention, media or marketing. We have incentives or policy programs. We have community-based types of programs that can reinforce one another. And the last is technology. And obviously, all of these types of programs are founded on the smart meter type of data, but there's also analytics that can be built upon that type of data. So I think we've talked about needing to make things simple for the consumer, because people aren't going to digest complex information in large quantities, and so we have to boil things down to a simple plan that's actionable. So doing analytics on the data to extract information about appliance-specific energy use, maybe using that information to do fault detection. I think Dan Riker mentioned that earlier, to tell you when your appliance is not functioning and should be replaced. Recommendations for controlling your appliances. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in incorporating different behavioral techniques and types of programs, as well as coming up with viable, innovative actions. So a lot of the actions that are proposed to people right now are actions that, for example, replace an energy-efficient appliance. Well, most people aren't going to do that unless their old appliance breaks, or they're remodeling, or unplug plug loads, vampire draws. That has a pretty small impact. So there are some viable behaviors that people can do, but can we expand the setup to behaviors that aren't going to create huge barriers to people and that they can do? For example, roll out a white tarp on their roof during the summer to reflect the energy use and reduce the heat inside, so that air conditioning doesn't need to be used as much. So I think there's going to have to be a constellation, a lot of pieces of investigating people's barriers and their motivations, and crafting programs and making things as easy as possible and fitting these all together in a very streamlined way, leveraging existing programs to really make this work and get the energy efficiency savings.
That's a very good point. In fact, it reminds me, Gene, you got that that new reality show, right? The Biggest Energy Loser. Are you working that through the Hollywood channels now? Good,
working it.
Okay, that's good. I'd like to now take a time. We have a few more minutes. So if we could do any closing comments, Gene, do you have any?
Sure. If there's one thing you take away from today, if there's one thing, it's two. It occurred to me. Thing number one is we got to stop talking about smart meters and smart grids. The one point of violent agreement that you heard from every single panelist today is what we're talking about is this is an enabling infrastructure. And if you think of it as an enabling infrastructure, you don't look at it wearing a white hat, come to rescue us. You look at it as allowing each and every one of us to put on the white hat. So that takes you to thing number two, which is what this panel's about. When we talk about behavior, even though it's very interesting as behavioral science, it's very interesting from a marketing perspective, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what makes it truly important is the end result. And what we really need is for each and every one of you today to stand up with me right now, raise your right hand, put it in your wallet, and give me $1. Because if everyone in this room did that one small act, I would amass a tremendous amount of money. But if every one of us in this room and your neighbors and everyone else in your city did a small act every single day to save energy, we would make a tremendous difference in the economics, in the reliability, and the environmental benefits that can be part of this nation's energy-consuming infrastructure. So behavior shouldn't be about what's the right approach or what's the wrong approach. Behavior should be about your agnosticism, just as long as we get everybody to participate, everybody to engage.
Good. Alex.
Closing thoughts. I mean, there's been a lot said. I think, you know, one thing I wanted to go back to is I think I misunderstood or, you know,
it's all right.
Your question about the apples. I think there's something exciting. I've been talking about, you know, I've mentioned that we're reducing consumption by 2.5%. All of that is with old-fashioned meters, old-fashioned two-legged meter readers who show up once a month. We have now deployed for the first time smart grid-enabled features with a couple of customers of ours. The early results are fantastic. And I think the sort of three flavors of apples, if you would, that are promising, in my perspective, that are promising not for the small, but the few, but promising for everybody, is the opportunity to run analysis in order to do disaggregation of usage. And that's actually the first thing that we've launched, is the opportunity to take hourly meter data, combine it with temperature data and humidity data, and without any more hardware in the house, actually be able to disaggregate for the customer, the average customer, how much they're using on heating, cooling, baseload, and show that in context, how they compare to others. We've done that with one of our first clients in Puget Sound Energy, and the impact of just showing customers the biggest leverage opportunity for them, showing them that it's, you know, they may be using 20% more than their neighbors, but they're using 60% more on heating, has resulted in a 50% increase in our efficacy. So that's one thing. I think the other thing, which was alluded to earlier, is the opportunity to provide alerts to customers. One of the things smart meters do is allow us to collect information more frequently, and then, of course, to communicate that information wisely more frequently to customers. And so it's the opportunity to get customers to sign up for an alert when they're trending towards a high usage, whether that comes via text message or email or phone call, that's a possibility. And then I think the third piece is just better targeting and analytics that are made possible by these meters and the opportunity. We're not going to make energy efficiency sexy for people. And if we're dependent on that, we're going to fail. But if we can take people's limited attention span, their inherent interest, and maximize, leverage our opportunity by providing that with a real insight, with a real actionable recommendation, I'm confident that we'll do, as Gene suggested, we will engage the overwhelming majority and get them to make more significant changes.
Thanks.
I think my one thing that I would hope we do is to think about consumers as social beings. When we talk about behavior, I mean, none of us acts alone, certainly not in this area. We know that people are, they care about what others think about them, they care about what they think of themselves, they're social in different ways, they have different kinds of households, they are connected to people in different ways. We don't understand what those differences of connection, of ethnicity, of age, of tech savviness, what those will mean for their energy use, or what appeals will be salient to them. It's time to start thinking about the customer as someone who is connected to ideas and to other people and to beliefs in very different ways. And not that we're that you treat treat each person as an individual, but that there are pockets of people who tend to think alike and act alike. So let's use our very well-established social marketing understandings and go after the energy user.
Well, please join me in thanking our speakers. We have just the time for a mic drop. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.